Welcome back to System Fix, a podcast from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain, and I am editor of New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa. Each episode of System Fix, we take a look at progress with reforms proposed for the New Zealand health system. These arose from the report of the Health and Disability System Review Panel, aka the Simpson Report. On System Fix, I speak with regular panellists and invited guests about the changes, the highs, the lows, what's happened to date, and what we might expect. Thanks for joining me. Warning, this podcast was recorded on the 2nd of February. Its broadcast has been delayed by flooding-related complications. I apologise for any confusion that may arise for listeners due to that delay. However, most of the commentary remains current. Like cheese, making health reform takes time. We cover a lot of ground this episode, so buckle in. Ngā mihi nui. Righty, welcome back.
Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year, everyone.
This is our first episode for 2023, and it's been quite a bit of time between episodes. So we've got a little bit to catch up on. So I thought we might take an unusual approach and almost like bullet points, like word association.
Oh, right, okay. Okay.
Let's start today's episode with new health minister. How do we feel about this change?
What I think is that it appears to be a bit of a circuit breaker. I wonder, you know, where the impetus came from, whether it was the Prime Minister himself or the former minister, but, you know, clearly relationships in the sector were getting a bit tetchy. I think it's to reduce the possibility that health reforms themselves will be another lightning rod in an election campaign along the lines of Three Waters.
I don't have much more to add to what Tim said. I try to have a view on everything, and thought I had was, it's probably unfair to say I'm a bit over it, but this narrative that we've now got a doctor in charge, so everything's okay, because we all know that the health system isn't only doctors, and a lot of the changes that are happening are not to the medical profession itself. I'm a bit bored of that narrative, but otherwise, I do think that there probably needed to be some kind of circuit breaker because things were looking a bit rough.
Totally agree about, you know, everything will be okay with the doctor as health minister. Well, they weren't okay the last time we had a doctor as health minister. And if you look internationally, there's no evidence. There's absolutely. Well, the one thing you could say is that doctors as health ministers are probably likely to be sometimes more willing to take on the medical profession because they know where the skeletons are buried.
I might be a little bit sheltered, but I possibly in the last couple of days with the flooding issues, I hadn't picked up on that narrative. And my first thoughts actually were more around political experience. And I was interested to see that Aisha Verrill is the first health minister who is actually a List MP. So she doesn't have the background experience of knocking on doors in electorates. And I thought that could create a little bit of a challenge because if there's anything we know about the health sector, it's all about relationships, shaking hands, making sure you're in the right place at the right time. And I suppose if you have done the footwork as an electorate MP, that's something you do probably pick up on a little bit. So it's a big step, I think, with a limited political experience.
There's a certain operational risk, I think, for the government in this.
Like one of the reasons you would want a senior cabinet minister to take on the portfolio is that their office will also be quite senior and know how things work. I expect her office will be less senior and will be needing quite a bit of support.
Yeah, some commentators suggested that Andrew Little would stay through to the election just to show support for the reforms that were in place. But on the other hand, we could argue that a good chunk of it is in place already. And as you said, Tim, the political lightning rod of health, it was possibly better to move him on.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. If we hadn't had a change of Prime Minister, I don't know whether we would have had a change of Minister. So these things sort of evolve quite quickly, don't they? I would imagine that it would have more likely have been status quo towards the election. Jacinda Ardern had remained Prime Minister.
Transition Unit. The transition unit closed on the 30th September. So that was quite a big step in the life of the health reforms. The actual reforms had come into effect on the 1st of July, but the transition unit stayed on for a few months extra. How do we feel about that process in terms of a way to initiate change? A transition unit mostly made up of private management consultants.
I'm in favour of the idea that there would be a separate group set up to manage it because we probably all think the health sector is the busiest sector in the world. It's very busy. The portfolio is huge. So if you don't have dedicated resource on something like this, it won't happen, I don't think. So I'm kind of in favour, more than kind of, I am in favour of something like a transition unit approach. But I think we've talked about it before, and I've probably betrayed some of my views here. I don't think it makes sense for that to be in mostly external consultants.
I think that's where it got interesting. I think the original decision, of course, we remember, was that it was located in Prime Minister and Cabinet, and that's what it was. But as the story evolved, it was clear that most of the resource was EY people. I think the risk there, I mean, apart from the argument about how reliant or not the public service is on consultants, and in the health sector, well, that issue is concentrated in a few areas, I think. I think the key issue is the continuity. I mean, of course, that goes with the territory. If you have a unit that's going to disband, then you're not going to have that continuity in implementation. But at least you want some continuity within government. So a big question there, following up on what you said, Gabrielle, was how much is Prime Minister and Cabinet going to sort of take an interest in the rollout implementation of the reforms? And are there going to be some people there that are across the detail and across what the issues are in implementation to report that up? Otherwise, it's just going to be, Cabinet is just going to have to rely on people in the sector who, as we know, there's inevitably, in a highly politicised portfolio, going to be a fair bit of arse covering going on from now on.
So the total cost for the reform program was $400 million, and the total cost to fund the transition unit was $36.39 million. Value for money?
I don't have a strong feeling about that. 9% of the total cost doesn't seem wildly out of whack to me.
Planned care.
Planned Care Task Force report, one of the first big reports to come out of the Te Whatu Ora, does focus on surgery and waiting times, electives.
Well, that's where the political heat is, for better or worse.
Getting things in place, able to benchmark stuff against and making promises about waiting times, although pretty soon we discovered that they weren't able to keep to the undertakings that were made because it comes back to workforce, which is another big issue for us at the moment.
Director General of Health.
We had a new Director General. Diana Safrati was announced, and Ashley has a knighthood.
He does.
Indeed.
And a new job in your backyard, Tim.
Yes, I mean, he's going to be based in Wellington, but I know he is actually, you know, sort of meeting people in Auckland. And my impression is he'll get here and make it up as you go, I think.
Te Pai Tata, the interim health plan.
Te Pai Tata, the interim health plan. Released in late October. So that's one of several documents that were touted in the Pai Ora legislation. We had the government policy statement on health, which came out earlier, and we're still waiting for the health charter. Interesting, because I kind of thought that might be one of the easier documents. The interim health plan, originally I thought it was going to be a budgeted document, but that seems to have been put off.
Yeah, it does seem to be put off, eh? I'm actually finding it very hard to figure out which way is up with some of this stuff. So I've read it a few times and I can see words in there that make me think, oh yeah, there's some thought gone into how some of these things all fit together. There's quite a lot of how does a treaty, Te Tiriti o Waitangi commitment and the equity priority, how does that translate into some of the work we're doing? Because I don't know which way is up all the time, to me it still looks a little bit like retrofitting a whole lot of actions that were already approved into some kind of order. Is it the main thing that they talk about in terms of the budget are the things that were already announced? I mean, which is not surprising. I acknowledge I wasn't expecting new money or anything, but I was expecting a different way to look at it maybe.
Yeah, I think that word retrofitting is really appropriate. What I struggle with the interim health plan is, what about it is a plan? It's an aspirational document, and that's all well and good, but we're getting plenty of those. And it sort of reflects the change in language, some of the change in thinking, some of the change in priorities, and that's all good to see that. But what is the plan element? I say that knowing that I'm on record as saying health planning is overrated as an idea. The reality is it's not a centralised system, and power and resources is actually very distributed. So the idea that anything can be planned to any degree is a bit of a myth, in my view. But we need these accountability documents, let's just put it that way.
Are you looking for more of a roadmap?
Not necessarily, because that could be just as fictional as well.
Fictional.
But what would be great, but I can totally understand why it doesn't happen, is a sort of a sense of prioritisation of the budget. But again, that's partly the way that health works, is that's almost impossible to take a blank sheet of paper approach to health. Wouldn't be a very good idea anyway. But on the other hand, so what purpose does the document have? Is it sort of the guiding light for all the documents that follow? How does it bite? How does it actually impact anything?
I was just trying to open it as you were talking, Tim, because the notes I made were around the cancer actions, and I just couldn't tell how was this adding any value to what we already had been talking about. So the two things I wrote down in my notes anyway, were one was around screening and one was about pharmac and cancer medications. Those things are always the things we talk about around cancer, really. What difference does this plan make?
So, I mean, the way I make sense of it is, okay, so in the Paora, the government said, let there be a plan. So we have to come up with something and let's put together the things that we can in the time available that might resemble some sort of plan. And so I wouldn't expect it to be hugely consequential, is what I'm saying. But okay. You know.
Commissioning.
One thing that has been quite new and different that's come out recently, we had the announcement of Abby Anderson as the new National Director of Commissioning. And then more recently, we've had the appointments of all the new commissioning people, regional wayfinders. So the introduction of new language. And in her interview with Martin Johnson, she did talk about the need to really be able to define what the wayfinders are doing. But then I saw the more recent document, Unifying for Simplicity. That left me a little bit confused. The Ministry of Health put out a document describing commissioning, how it's going to differ from contracting. That was really interesting. It did have a real determination to actually move away from how we work now.
All this is quite consistent with a lot of international developments. And the key change is, you know, these ideas of co-design. Let's find out what people want, what services people want. And that's all good that that's now sort of been, what's the word, promoted to front and centre. However, the fundamental thing that has to happen with commissioning is how are we going to use what is inevitably a limited pool of funding to make decisions about what services are funded and what ones not. And the way that will emerge from this process, I think, is the big question mark for me. The senior leadership of Te Whatu Ora and Taka Whai Ora are going into this with goodwill to try and sort of put some flesh on the bones, but there's going to be a point where the limits are going to be sort of experienced very quickly, and then you know the usual sorts of politics around who gets what in the health sector.
Iwi Māori Partnership Boards.
Iwi Māori Partnership Boards. Our last podcast, Gabrielle and Simon Royal, has been getting a lot of attention. It's obviously an area that people are wanting to learn more about. And I think at the beginning of this year, we had the announcement that we now have 11 Iwi Māori Partnership Boards in place. They are really crucial to the development of localities and commissioning. Gabrielle, are you hearing much from the sector around progress in that area?
I'm actually hearing lots of activity. So in that sense, yes, I think that the Iwi Māori Partnership Boards, my take on it is they're in the stage of strategic planning about how they're going to work and how they're going to engage in the localities and how they're going to use, for want of a better word, their influence there. So I think they're definitely in that kind of building a platform foundational phase.
Localities.
Localities, I think we've got 12 on record now. One thing I noticed when I was just having a look through some older articles for today, reminding myself that if we don't have localities covering the whole country by 2024, that the boundaries will be put in place and potentially amended at a later stage. People are just crying out for more information. Presumably, it's going to come in the wake of the setup of the commissioning structure, because that's what they're there for.
I mean, my sense of the one to watch closely, I mean, they're all going to be interesting, but the one to watch, the South Auckland one, there's this ambiguity about how much it has to be a geographic boundaries, which is always going to be the problem in urban areas more generally anyway, but this is kind of the test case. We'll see some indications about how far that locality wants to push, who's in, whether they are confined to a particular geographic area, and if not, how will Te Whatu Ora, you know, provide guidance for others that might want to do similar sorts of things?
When Tim was talking before about the geographic boundary issues, I just had this massive flashback to the better, sooner, more convenient business cases where they did not deal well with the geographic issue. So I'm more hopeful that the localities will.
Primary health organisations.
In the meantime, we're seeing people moving within the sector. Some of the PHOs are losing quite a lot of senior staff. And the legislation at the time kind of saw an end to PHOs, but other PHOs are building up their capacity because at the moment they are the core of capacity around primary care.
Data.
Another big item which came out recently was the first report on data and digital, the primary care data stocktake, which raised issues around ownership of data, sovereignty of data, standards for data.
Is that report public?
Yes, it is.
Capitation and pay parity.
We did get a hold of the capitation review that was done last year, I think, by the Transition Unit and had been with the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. We had been chasing that under the Official Information Act, but it was actually quietly put onto the Prime Minister and Cabinet website where we found it. And that was quite an interesting report, particularly with regard to high needs practices and equity. The reviewers modelled varying levels of funding to address unmet need and suggest very high needs practice require between 34% and 231% more capitation funding than they're getting at the moment. And the reality is that nothing is going to happen until we get another budget, but also the new health funding models aren't likely to be finalised until at least the middle of 2023.
I think that story is fascinating. And I was going to ask you, Barbara, was the fact that it was somewhere there on the DPMC website, you think intentional or an oversight?
I think it's probably a bit of a mixture of both. We have been requesting it for quite some time, and I suspect there may have been some other media outlets after it as well. It wasn't the first place we would have thought to have gone and looked for it, but when you think about it, the Transition Unit was in Prime Minister and Cabinet, and the narrative that came out with it was that it's not really 100% relevant anymore. That it was a review done by the Transition Unit and it will feed into decisions in the future. It's not like the be-all and end-all. Whereas I think when it was first mooted that we thought the capitation review was what it was, a review of capitation, and that there will be action as a result of it. Whereas now the narrative is that it's actually just one part of a larger look at the funding. Every now and then I hark back to the fact that we have these reforms because 6 years ago the sector was promised a review of primary care funding.
To me, these things seem to end up in stalemate, and I think the nurses, primary care nurses pay equity example is another good example. And we can talk about the intentions of the people involved, but I think there's broader structural reasons why these sorts of issues, how primary care is paid, is so damn difficult in policy and government to deal with, and that's because it's a very strange beast. You know, it's a publicly funded service where the key operators are private businesses. You know, if you talked about ACC and physiotherapists, there's a hell of a lot more, I guess, transparency about how that works. But there's a very different sort of power dynamic that goes on in primary care, in which government is naturally suspicious because it doesn't control the funding flows. And primary care is naturally frustrated because government doesn't have good information. And both things are true. And I think the exchange between Andrew Little and Tim Malloy is just lovely stuff. I mean, I'd love to use it for teaching.
Do you just want to explain a little bit for it to our listeners?
Certainly.
What that was about?
That was the argument about whether, well, I guess PHOs should be given additional money in order to deal with the implications of the pay rise for nurses in hospital sector, the growing gap between pay rates for hospital nurses and primary care nurses. There's a couple of letters in the New Zealand Doctor website, an exchange between Tim Malloy representing GenPro, primary care practices, and Andrew Little as minister. And this is a fascinating exchange, which is full of claim and counterclaim and cherry picking of evidence on both sides and, quite enlightening as to what the deeper problems actually are, where people are talking past each other.
We're just working on background articles on pay parity and pay equity. It's a very, very complex and confusing area. But essentially now we've got to the point with this latest pay equity increase with the DHB nurses that pay parity, the difference now for the senior nurses is about 20,000, which is a significant problem for primary care, aged care, NGOs employing nurses.
Primary care funding.
Just going back to the report on capitation models, I mean, I think that will have a long life, that report. I think it's going to influence something somewhere, whether that's publicly acknowledged or not, because the level of detail in that report is just unprecedented, yeah. I think.
fed into that has been the Y2575 material as well.
That's why I was thinking about, you know, this is a thorny health sector, public health funding issue. But there's just this consistent series of reports and findings about how Māori providers, especially in primary health care, are not funded adequately. So it's hard not to be cynical and say this is a group that can be deprioritized. By doing nothing, you're prioritizing the group that's already benefiting.
Pay equity in primary care, there was money to go into the NGO Māori Pacifica nurses, but they haven't actually released any detail yet as to how that money is actually going to be distributed. And they specifically excluded general practice. But yet again, the delay in getting any kind of money out there.
And to be honest, that's what I'm hearing a lot from Māori providers at the moment, that there's a whole, because of all this kind of, it's my word, all of the chaos of trying to figure out what's going to be different and how people are going to experience a different kind of health system. I think Māori providers are a bit caught in the middle, probably along with lots of providers, of what's transitioned from the Ministry of Health to Te Whatu Ora to Te Aka Whai Ora, and I don't think they're feeling any particular benefit just yet.
I think that's true. I'm sort of hearing stories of NGOs or contracts sort of being sort of lost, and this happened last time. This happened 20 years ago. Contracts were lost so that there was nobody in the funding agency that had oversight of what the funding arrangement was for NGOs. And, you know, that's going to be churn of people working in Te Whatu Ora, and there's a whole lot of reasons why it's going to happen. But I suspect it's going to happen a lot over the next year.
Performance targets.
Another thing we had recently since the new year was the release of some new performance targets. You know, something you're very fond of, Tim.
Yeah, but I'm a bit behind the eight ball on this one. I link to that.
Go into the New Zealand Doctor and look in the document archive.
These look very similar to the health service indicators that were announced in August 2021. I noticed a couple of things have dropped off the list, which is the financial performance indicators that nobody was in the ministry was terribly happy with anyway, but seemed to be something the Treasury wanted. So they're not there anymore. And what we actually have is some bits of the old targets in elective surgery waiting lists and the old SB targets.
The emergency department targets.
So what we've got is emergency department attendances reflects the number of people who present. Okay, that doesn't tell us anything. And ED admissions, well, this is a good sign that they're separating ED admissions from ED attendances. So focusing on the admissions part of it, I think, is really important, because most of the issues that we know about in EDs are still because of admitted patients not being able to get a place in the wards, because the people in the wards aren't getting out of the hospital. It's interesting. It looks like an interesting hybrid of things that we've had before. It's a move back to sort of service process indicators, a little bit away from outcomes.
I'm just reading the performance report for the immunisation rates for children at 24 months. And one of the things that I heard people talk about the establishment of Te Aka Whai Ora in the early days, I would always say, I think that if you want quick wins, something I think we should focus on is our immunisation rates. Because post-COVID, the rates for Māori children went down abysmally. And so when I look at the immunisation rates as one of the performance metrics, and they're reporting 67.3%,
which is back children to 2007 levels.
Yeah, which is right back. Yep. And non-Māori, non-Pacific population is at 85.8%, so it's not obviously everybody who is dropping back. And certainly not at the same rate. So that concerns me, and I would hope that, well, I'll probably do more than hope, but I would want to see that fixed.
Totally agree. It's the easiest thing to tackle in a short space of time, I would say, if you really want to early runs on the board, which is not to say it's easy for people in the sector. And I think what we learnt from 10 years ago when the immunisation target was one of the more successful ones was that it was an enormous amount of effort for people in the sector. And the thing that was never really fixed was the extent to which within mainstream primary care there was sort of follow-up and outreach, particularly, I think, to Māori tamariki.
Yeah, and I think this shows anything that did happen there wasn't embedded.
Exactly. The success in the target was due to immunisation coordinators and PHOs and DHBs just doing an incredible job at just finding those that hadn't been immunised and then, you know, doing something. But that was unsustainable.
Appointments.
So from metrics to appointments, so we've seen a large number of permanent appointments now to Te Whatu Ora and Te Apawhai Ora and to the Regional Public Health Service. It was interesting to see Sharon Shea step down from the Te Apawhai Ora board, stating that she's more interested in getting back to frontline, you know, provider work rather than governance. And she's been in the process from way back as an advisor in the advisory committee to the Simpson panel. In terms of the appointments to Te Apawhai Ora, it's a smaller organisation, so it's pretty critical for them to be getting permanent appointments in place as soon as possible. Have you got any sense of how well they're going there, Gabrielle?
Not really, because these appointments, some of them were only starting this year, I think, right? So yeah. I would be absolutely unfair of me to make any comment on it, just that I hope they do really well.
Yeah.
Disability and the Waitangi Tribunal.
Another area going on in parallel with all this is the development of the Disability Ministry, and the Permanent Chief Executive there has been appointed since we last spoke as well.
Paula Tesserero.
Gabrielle, now the treaty claim still going on for disability?
Yeah, so that Te Tiriti inquiry around disability, tribunal inquiry, week 5 will be in March. It's probably still another couple of years away having a report on that. It's a big undertaking. So I think what the tribunal's trying to do is get some early wins, if possible. So getting claimants and the Crown to come together and think about some things that could be done as a result of what we've heard so far and not have to wait until a tribunal report.
Yeah.
Which will be interesting to see how that goes. And Whaikaha is kind of interesting because they don't have the same kind of structural requirements that Te Akawhai Ora and Te Whatu Ora have, because they're not set up by the same kind of legislation. Mm-hmm. So they've got a little bit more freedom, I expect, to figure out how they're going to run. So they've set up some committees that are ensuring tangata whaikaha and tangata whaikaha Māori are able to influence at a high level. So it'll be interesting to see how that works and whether that supports good connection with the health agencies.
So when you say it'd be another couple of years before the final report, from your experience, how do you keep the momentum going over that period of time?
It's hard. So one of the main differences between this stage of the inquiry and the primary care one was the primary care inquiry only had 2 claimants, technically. There was only needing to have 2 claims heard in full and only the evidence from those 2 claims plus some interested parties. It was a much more compact and defined inquiry, whereas the disability one is just so big and it's supposed to be disability and health. But there are questions that I think everyone's scooting around, including the tribunal, in my view, around things like, does it include ACC?
Right.
We've got a very long way to go before those kind of issues are sorted. And the Crown isn't set to give evidence, I think, until after hearing week eight, which is after the end of this year.
Workforce.
We're kind of getting down to the last nuts and bolts of trying to remind ourselves of what's happened in the last 4 months. I recently had a new reporter start at New Zealand Doctor, and I start by giving them a whiteboard outline of what the health sector looks like and what we might want it to look like, or the high order legislation. And I've got all this stuff drawn up on the board, and I say, okay, so even if it all goes according to plan, there's one big, big problem, and that is the workforce to actually staff all these new roles, to meet these new targets, new models of care. At that point, I just don't really know where to go, because our workforce is just so challenged at the moment. Even trying to think about new ways of doing things, we're thinking about new ways of doing things because we don't have the people here to do the things that have always been done.
Every country is talking about health workforce shortages, which is not good for us. Because in an international labour market, probably the dynamics are going to be people flowing out rather than people flowing in. Overall, there's no quick fix here. I'd love to play up the silver lining, which is, well, you know, this will force some different models, and I think it will in some areas, but we're also dealing with a labour force that is highly bound by sort of professional colleges and scopes of practice. I mean, the unregulated workforce is where, or you know, what's called, I don't like that term, but you know, that's where I think we might see the most dynamism and, you know, interesting things happening, is because there's fewer sort of impediments to innovation, doing new things. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult in areas which still think that they rely on professional registered workforces. Sorry, that's not very optimistic.
It'd be interesting if we actually you know, started from scratch on how we designed healthcare professionals and healthcare workers, and would we have the same scopes of practice? Would we?
The very idea of scopes of practice is under severe strain, I think, because of its, I guess, inbuilt inflexibility. It's there for a good reason, but it's very complex. Managers have no power over this stuff whatsoever. Mm. So as much as they'd like to be able to reconfigure services, they're totally at a loss when it comes to, you know, doing anything that would run into scopes of practice issues.
COVID has taught us that, you know, needs must. And when the need was there, communities created their own different ways of doing things. And it was like they were given this little bit of permission. Okay, you can do it for now. But actually, at the end of the day, no, that works. You can do it forever.
Transparency.
One other area that I just think has been kind of interesting in the last 6 months has been the approaches to transparency by Te Whatu Ora. For the listeners' sake, we've kind of got to the point now where Te Whatu Ora board meetings, they will have the media present via Zoom at the beginning of the meetings, then close the meetings, and then have a media stand-up at the end. I think there's been quite a bit of criticism of Te Whatu Ora because it's not DHBs, but then I think given the legislation didn't require them to be transparent and accountable in this way, I think it is actually good. You know, it is progress. They still have a habit of putting stuff onto their website without sending out maybe a media release or an alert to say that new material is there, and that's a frustration. I have really noticed the impact of centralisation of the service. So whereas before we had all the different DHBs sending material out, we don't get anywhere near as much material coming in from the districts as we used to. I think it's harder for Te Whatu Ora to tell its own story about what it's doing because it's still holding on quite tightly to the information that it creates. And obviously, politically, it's also trying to avoid controversy. But I give them points for going beyond what they are required to do, and actually media stand-ups, you know, most welcome.
I'd just like to see how that process evolves. It's going to be the creation of a new ritual, a new game, if you like, between the media and Te Whatu Ora. And I imagine you're going to be quite crucial players in that in New Zealand Doctor. So,
well, we do like to keep our hand in, that's for sure. Yeah. Certainly, I'm always aware that with the general media, I mean, a lot of the newsrooms are quite challenged for staff as well. And it's kind of easy to stick with the classic stories of hospital waiting lists and personal tragedies.
It's got to be a bit of a two-way thing here. Of the large media organisations generally have always been a bit weak in terms of health sector coverage. You know, sort of the depth. There's rarely been specialist health reporters in major news organisations, and when there were some, they weren't always that good.
It is hard to become a specialist in anything in the newsrooms now.
That's right.
Because they are kind of short staffed, and that's the hard thing for the health sector is it needs people watching what's going on. And for the localities, you know, it's all about community and getting people interested in what's happening in their health service. I mean, I always give the example of, you know, when we're pregnant and having babies, we're totally interested in maternity services, but 2 years down the road, we don't want to go there. Thanks, Gabrielle and Tim. Today, we've just tried to get up to speed with what's been happening over the last 4 months and getting our health policy system fix brains back into action after the Christmas break. Hopefully, you guys both did get a good break. And I'm really looking forward to chatting to you again this year throughout the year and seeing what progress we get with system fix and with the health reforms. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks for listening to System Fix, brought to you by the Health Media. If you would like to learn more about the health reforms and other issues in primary care, you can subscribe to New Zealand Doctor, Rāte Aotearoa, on nzdoctor.co.nz. Or to keep up with issues in the pharmacy sector, go to pharmacytoday.co.nz. Both publications now offer monthly subscriptions. Thank you to Steve Hart for post-production work on System Fix. This is Barbara signing off. Until next time, thanks for listening. Nga mihi nui.